and gentlemen, welcome to the main event. Let's get ready to rumble!
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network. Mr. Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker. Right next to Terrible Tommy, Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Grilling Station.
When are you going to get that through your head, mister? It's White Aryan Resistance, not Insurgent anymore. Come on. This is Terrible Tommy right here in the bunker. And on an overcast day, no rain, no snow, but overcast and cool. And we're close to the P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana. That's where everybody sends their moolah, so I can spend some time on the Riviera. I think almost everybody's got their donation for the show in already. So that's good, man. That's good. Probably most of you are not here today because you're on your way to Washington, D.C. to see Mr. Trump get in there. I hope you're not one of those people that say, I ain't going down there. I don't like that guy. He ain't legitimate. I'm going to stay home. Actually, that's all right with me. I think there's nothing wrong with that. If you don't like somebody, if you hate somebody, then you're being honest if you don't go. Republicans aren't that honest because a whole lot of them turned out to that Obama get-together. Hardly any of them stayed home. They didn't want to look like they're offending Mr. African-American. But hell, if people say they don't want to go, don't go. We don't want you there anyhow. Leaves us all these extra seats, man. We could bring all the lone wolves in there and put them on the front row. Keep an eye on Mr. Trump. Here today, they had a press. No, they didn't have a press conference. They had a luncheon, I guess, after the Presidente got to Washington. And it was supposedly no press there, and the press showed up, and I heard that Mr. Trump tossed him out. I like that kind of stuff. He does a lot of stuff I really like. Yeah. Hey, I saw a picture today. You know, you don't see this very much because they play this down. It was Representative Lewis from Atlanta, and he had a middle-aged white woman sitting next to him that wasn't bad for her age. And that must be his wife. Those niggeroos, boy, they've got to have them a trophy wife. You check them out. Either a white trophy wife or an Asian trophy wife or even sometimes a white, light Mexican wife. Yeah. Isn't that something? She's sitting there beside this little, she should have had a chain around his neck, a leash. To lead him around, because he looks like some kind of a, well, I don't know. He looks like some kind of a mongoloid midget is what he looks like. But anyhow, there you go. Another white person who's got some power that immediately they marry a white woman. Got themselves a white haw there, babe. Got to have that. And she was looking, smiling, just as happy as punch. Of course, he's surrounded by white sycophant Republicans and Democrats, most now right now Democrats, but he has had plenty of Republicans around kissing his ass, saying, "Oh, how wonderful you look, Mrs. Lewis. You look so fine." Yeah. Mm-hmm. I hate those white bastards worse than I could have any hatred for black. You know, don't you? If you don't, I don't know. There's something wrong with you. White race mixers and ass kissers and phony race mixers, which you know what they're saying behind closed doors in the bedroom at night with their wives, what they think of these people. But they will not say it in public because they've got no guts. You and I, we've got guts. They have no guts because they're in it for the power and the money. And these white people will do anything for the power and the money, just like their slave master plantation owners did back in the day. Got an email today from this guy by the name of Daryl Smith. He's this black that goes around converting Klansmen, getting them out of the Klan. And he sent me an email. He wants to sit down with me and talk. He wants to talk, and then he wants to put me in a chapter of his book. I emailed him back, and I said, no, there's not going to be any days like that, mister. You just go on down the path to these other people that turn on their own. Daryl, he's a big, fat, slob Negro, and these right-wingers will let him interview him. They'll let him into their home and everything else, thinking they're going to escalate the Klan a little bit. Well, we don't play that game anymore. I used to play some games with these press people, but I ain't playing it anymore. I've turned down two or three of them in the last month. I say, look, you can find out everything you want to know about me by going to resist.com. Just go to resist.com. You don't have to interview me. It's all up there. And more. Well, I hope all those radical regressives don't do me bad. I want to see them do me good. I'm dependent on them to tear the shit out of things. They deputized, 1,000 National Guardsmen today. And they got the bikers coming in. And then they got the Washington police. I think they're loaded for bear. So you regressives, do me proud. Get out there and raise some hell. I can't wait to see it. I can't wait to see it. Because if you believe truthfully what you believe, then that's what you should do. And I respect you for it. Even though I don't agree with you on most of it, some of it I do. But you just get out there and do us proud. Do Lenin proud. Yeah. He'd be proud of you. But he's not going to be proud of you if you get out there like a bunch of pussies. We used to battle them in the streets big time. I don't know whether the current group of people has what it takes. They talk, they yell, they scream, they cry.
We ain't going to come to your inauguration.
How sad is that? They should be saying, well, we're coming to your inauguration and we're bringing a baseball bat with us. Then I'd give them respect. These Hollywood people, I can't wait if they drop this section of the government for the arts and movies and all that shit and dump PBS, even though there is sometimes good stuff on there. I want to see that. I want to see those 100 executive orders coming down like snowflakes from the sky. And then I'll get down on my knees and say, I praise the Lord to Mr. Trump. He's really the man. He's really the man. this is more fun than the barrel of monkeys, boys and girls. Congressman Lewis, he's not going to bring his white bitch with him. He wouldn't do that. I can imagine what Trump says behind closed doors about that. Well, I'm glad that little fucker kept his white shishka, kept her home. That Obama's smarter than you think. He got out of Washington as fast as he could. He headed for California, down there at Palm Springs. I don't blame him getting out of there. He don't want to be blamed for whatever happens. Saying, I didn't tell him to set fire to that building. Not me. I wouldn't do that. That's un-American. I just hope the people who listen to me, which there's probably not that many, have brains enough to stay away from that crap. Don't get caught up in it. Let them go after each other. Let them brawl in the streets. Let them break things. Yeah, that is Operation Chaos. both sides, Republican and Democrat, are playing into our hands beautifully. And it's just getting started. This is not going to end. They're going to keep this going for a long time. Well, boys and girls, I just can't hold it back. I've been trying to, but I've been thinking about it all day, and it keeps clawing at my brain. It's time to introduce Might is Right on the eve of the assumption of power by the Mr. Trumpy. Ragnar Redbeard, let's go with it. I get you all hot and trotting. You might want to get on a bus and go to D.C., but I don't recommend it. Just stand by and watch the fun.
Opportunities. A man's opportunities are never exhausted so long as other men, who are not his friends, possess millions of acres and thousands of tons of gold. The guarded treasure halls and ironclad temples of modern kings and presidents, high priests and millionaires, are positively the richest the world has ever known. Bulging are they with the vast hoards of silver and diamonds and gold. Here, then, is opportunity on a colossal scale. Here is the goal of the Caesars, Nebuchadnezzars, and Napoleons in the days that are coming. All is ready and prepared for them, even as in olden times. Caesar carried off the treasures of Egypt, Greece, Gaul, and Rome. Napoleon looted the money vaults of Venice, Vienna, Madrid, Berlin, and Moscow. London only escaped him. Nebuchadnezzar plundered the Temple of Zion, where the Jews kept all their deposits and drank his beer and wine out of Jehovah's pots of gold. Napoleon, Caesar, Nebuchadnezzar. They were three great men, were they not? And in this their greatness consisted. They seized their opportunities. All else is error. The natural world is a world of war. The natural man is a warrior. The natural law is tooth and claw. All else is error. A condition of combat everywhere exists. We are born into a perpetual conflict. It is our inheritance, even as it was the heritage of previous generations. This condition of combat may be disguised with the holy phrases of St. Francis, or the soft, deceitful doctrines of a Kropotkin or Tolstoy, but it cannot be eventually evaded by any human being, or any tribe of human beings. It is there, and it stays there, and each man, whether he will or not, has to reckon with it. It rules all things. It governs all things. It reigns over all things, and it decides all who imagine policemanized populations, internationally regulated tranquility, and state-organized industrialism so joyful, blessed, and divine. It's the gold. Virtue is rewarded in this world, remember. Natural law makes no false judgments. Its decisions are true and just, even when dreadful. The victor gets the gold and the land every time. He also gets the fairest maidens, the glory tributes, and why should it be otherwise? Why should the delights of life go to failures and cowards? Why should the spoils of battle belong to the unwarlike? That would be insanity, utterly unnatural and immoral. Behold the crucifix. What does it symbolize? Pallid incompetence hanging on a tree. Lo, I hear the fighters coming, over hill and dell and plain, with the battle cry of ages in a rebel world again, who'd forged their swords to plowshares, shall sweat in bitter yokes. The freeborn race and fearless must deal out battle strokes. In the wars of the great Caesar and grim Hannibal, in the times of Belshazzar, the pharaohs and all, the days of Rienzi and Roland the Bold, all banners are waving for women and gold. It is might against might, remember, by land and sea, man against man, money against money, brains against brains, and everything to the winner. Chapter 1. Introductory. In this arid wilderness of steel and stone, I raise up my voice that you may hear. To the east and to the west I beckon. To the north and to the south I show a sign proclaiming, death to the weakling, wealth to the strong. Open your eyes that ye may hear, O men of mildewed minds, and listen to me, ye laborious millions. For I stand forth to challenge the wisdom of the world, to interrogate the laws of man and of God. I request reasons for your golden rule and ask the why and wherefore of your Ten Commands. Before none of your printed idols do I bend in acquiescence, and he who saith, thou shalt to me, is my mortal foe. I demand proof over all things, and accept, with reservations, even that which is true. I dip my forefinger in the watery blood of your impotent mad redeemer, your divine democrat, your Hebrew madman, and write over his thorn-torn brow, the true prince of evil, the king of the slaves. No hoary falsehood shall be a truth to me. No cult or dogma shall encramp my pen. I break away from all conventions, alone, untrammeled. I raise up in stern invasion the standard of strong. I gaze into the glassy eye of your fearsome Jehovah and pluck him by the beard. I uplift a broad axe and split open his worm-eaten skull. I blast out the ghastly contents of philosophic whited sepulchres and laugh with sardonic wrath. Then, reaching up the festering and varnished facades of your haughtiest moral dogmas, I write thereon in letters of blazing scorn, lo and behold, all this is fraud. I deny all things, I question all things, and yet, gather around me, O ye death-defiant, and the earth itself shall be thine, the have and the hold. What is your civilization and progress, if its only outcome is hysteria and downgoing? What is government and law, if their ripened harvests are men without sap? What are religions and literatures, if their grandest productions are hordes of faithful slaves? What is evolution and culture if their noxious blossoms are sterilized women? What is education and enlightenment if their Dead Sea fruit is a caitiff race with rottenness in its bones? 2. How is it that men of light and leading hardly ever call in question the manufactured moral codes under which our once vigorous northern race is slowly and surely eating out its heart in peaceful inaction and laborious dry rot? Standard moral principles are arbitrarily assumed by their orthodox apologists to be a fixed and unalterable quantity, and that to doubt the divine rightness of these principles is treason and sacrilege. When the greatest thinkers of a race are incapable or afraid to perform their manifest and logical function, it is scarcely to be wondered that average citizens are also somewhat unwilling to risk life, fortune, and sacred honor for the overthrow of popularized right and wrong concepts, that they know from bitter personal experience or unworkable falsities. Although the average man feels in his heart that nearly all political and religious conventionalisms are dynamic deceits, yet how cautiously he avoids any open display of antagonism thereto. He has not the courage of his opinions. He is afraid to say openly what he thinks secretly. In other words, he is living in a state of subjectiveness, of vassalage. He allows his brain to be dominated and held in bondage by the brain of another. From his infancy, he has been deliberately subjected to a continuous external pressure, especially designed to coerce his understanding into strict accord with prearranged views of moral, political, or religious duty. He has not been permitted one moment of real mental liberty. He imbibed fraudulent conventionalisms with his mother's milk. He listens to the most hideous lies being glorified in his presence as sublime truths. He hears falsehoods sung in swelling chorus. He hears them sounded on bugles of silver and brass. He hears them intoned by congregations of the faithful amid peals of sacred music and the solemn roll of chanted prayer. Thus his mind is sterilized by authority before it has had a chance to mature. Thus youth is mentally castrated, that its natural vitality may be afterwards used up in the yoke of custom, which is the yoke of slavery. In the nursery, at school, and at college, plastic brain pulp is deliberately forced into the prearranged mold. Everything that a corrupt civilization can do is done to compress the growing intellect into unnatural channels. Thus, the great mass of men who inhabit the world of today have no initiative, no originality or independence of thought, but are mere subjective individualities who have never had the slightest voice in fashioning the ideals that they formally revere. Although the average man has taken no part in manufacturing moral codes and statute laws, yet how he obeys them with dog-like submissiveness. He is trained to obedience like oxen are broken to the yoke of their masters. He is a born thrall, habituated from childhood to be governed by others. Chinese civilization deliberately distorts its children's feet by swathing them in bandages of silk and hoop iron. Christian civilization crushes and cramps the minds of its youth by means of false philosophies, artificial moral codes, and ironclad political creeds. Deleterious sub-theories of good and evil are systematically injected into our natural literatures, and gradually, without serious obstruction, they crystallize themselves into cast-iron formulas, infallible constitutions, will-o'-the-wisp evangels, and other deadly epidemics. Modern leaders of thought are almost wholly wanting in originality and courage. Their wisdom is foolishness, their remedies poison. They idiotically claim that they guide the destinies of nations, whereas in reality they are but the flotsam and scum froth that glides smoothly down the dark stream of decadence. Thus all the people of the earth are helpless, seeing those that lead are blind. Mankind is aweary of its sham prophets, its demagogues, and its statesmen. It crieth out for kings and heroes. It demands a nobility that cannot be hired with money, like slaves or beasts of burden. The world awaits the coming of mighty men of valor, great destroyers, destroyers of all that is vile, angels of death. We are sick unto nausea of the good Lord Jesus, terror-stricken under the executive of priest, mob, and proconsul. We are tired to death of equality. Gods are at a discount. Devils are in demand. He who would rule the coming age must be hard, cruel, and deliberately intrepid, for softness assails not successfully the idols of the multitude. Those idols must be smashed into fragments, burnt into ashes, and that cannot be done by the gospel of love. The living forces of evil are to be found in the living ideals of today. The commandments and laws and moral codes that are called upon to reverence and obey are themselves the insidious enginery of decadence. It is moral principles that manufacture beggars. It is golden rules that glorify meekness. It is statute laws that make spaniels of men. A man may keep every one of the Ten Commandments and yet remain a fool all the days of his life. He may obey every written law of the land and yet be a caitiff and a slave. He may love Jesus, delight in the golden rule, and yet continue to the hour of his death, a failure and dependent. Truly the way to hell is by fulfilling the commandments of God. If the all-conquering race to which we belong is not to irretrievably dwindle into multitudinous nothingness, like the inferior herds it has outdistanced or enslaved, then it is essential that the Semitic spider webs, so astutely woven for ages into the brains of our chiefs, be remorselessly torn out by the very roots, even though the tearing out process be both painful and bloody. If we would retain and defend our inherited manhood, we must not permit ourselves to be forever rocked to repose with the sweet lullabies of Eastern idealisms. Too long we have been hypnotized by the occult charm of Hebrew utopianism. If we continue to obey the insidious spell that has been laid upon us, we will wake up some dread morning with the gates of hell upon earth, yawning wide open, to close again upon us forever. The idea of hell is in some respects a truthful conception, suggestive of actual fact. If we terrestrialize the location, there is nothing inharmonious about it. Many a race, many a tribe, and many a mighty empire has gone down into a grimly realistic Sheol. Is it not right and just that the vile, the base, and the degenerate, that is to say, the slave nations of the earth, should be punished piteously for their creeping cowardice? Is it not right that they should be, as it were, fried and toasted, should swim in pools of boiling blood or dance sweltering satanic glees with blistered feet and straining eyeballs on red-hot Saharas of gravel and sand. In actual operation, nature is cruel and merciless to men, as to all other beings. But a tribe of human animals live a rational life. Nature will smile upon them and their posterity. But let them attempt to organize an unnatural mode of existence, an equality Elysium, and they will be punished even to the point of extermination. 3. All ethics, politics, and philosophies are pure assumptions. Built upon assumptions, they rest on no sure basis. They are but shadowy castles in the air erected by daydreamers or by rogues upon nursery fables. It is time they were firmly planted upon an enduring foundation. This can never be accomplished until the racial mind has first been thoroughly cleansed and drastically disinfected of its depraved, alien, and demoralizing concepts of right and wrong. In no human brain can sufficient space be found for the relentless logic of hard fact until all pre-existent delusions have been finally annihilated. Half measures are of no avail. We must go down to the very roots and tear them out, even to the last fiber. We must be, like nature, hard, cruel, relentless. Too long the dead hand has been permitted to sterilize living thought. Too long right and wrong, good and evil, have been inverted by false prophets. In the days that are at hand, neither creed nor code must be accepted upon authority, human, superhuman, or divine. Morality and conventionalism are for subordinates. Religions and constitutions and all arbitrary principles, every mortal theorem, must be deliberately put to the question. No moral dogma must be taken for granted, no standard of measurement deified. There's nothing inherently sacred about moral codes. Like the wooden idols of long ago, they are all the work of human hands, and what man has made, man can destroy. He that is slow to believe anything and everything is of great understanding, for belief in one false principle is the beginning of all unwisdom. The chief duty of every new age is to upraise new men to determine its liberties, to lead it towards material success, to rend, as it were, the rusty padlocks and chains of dead custom that always prevent healthy expansion. Theories and ideals and constitutions that may have meant life and hope and freedom for our ancestors may now mean destruction, slavery, and dishonor to us. As environments change, no human ideal standeth sure. Wherever, therefore, a lie has built unto itself a throne, let it be assailed without pity and without regret, for under the domination of a falsehood, no nation can permanently prosper. Let established sophisms be dethroned, rooted out, burnt, and destroyed, for they are a standing menace to all true nobility of thought and action. Whatever alleged truth is proven by results to be but an empty fiction, let it be unceremoniously flung into the outer darkness among the dead gods, dead empires, dead philosophies, and other useless lumber and wreckage. The most dangerous of all enthroned lies is the holy, the sanctified, the privileged lie, the lie that everybody believes to be a model truth. It is the fruitful mother of all other popular errors and delusions. It is hydra-headed. It has a thousand roots. It is a social cancer. The lie that is known to be a lie is half eradicated, but the lie that even intelligent persons regard as a sacred fact, the lie that has been inculcated around a mother's knee, is more dangerous to contend against than a creeping pestilence. Popular lies have ever been the most potent enemies of personal liberty. There is only one way to deal with them. Cut them out to the very core, just as cancers are. Exterminate them root and branch, or they will surely eat us all up. We must annihilate them, or they will us. Half and half remedies are of no avail. However, when a lie has gone too far, when it has taken up its abode in the very tissues, bones, and brains of a people, then all remedies are useless. Even the lancet is of no avail. Repentance of past misdeeds cannot save decadence from extermination. The fatal bolt is shot, and into the fiery furnace of wholesale slavery and oblivion they must go, to be there righteously consumed. From their ashes, something new, something nobler, may possibly evolve, but even that is the merest optimistic supposition. In nature, the wages of sin is always death. Nature does not love the wrongdoer, but endeavors in every possible way to destroy him. Her curse is on the brow of the meek and lowly. Her blessing is on the very hearts' blood of the strong and the brave. Only Jews and Christs and other degenerates think that rejuvenation can ever come through law and prayer. All the tears of all the martyrs might just as well have never been shed. 4. Whatsoever a people believeth shall make it free, enslave it, or corrode its very marrow in strict accordance with natural order. Consequently, if a people place implicit faith in what philosophers teach them, they are liable to be duped. If many nations are so duped, their deception is a menace to the liberty of the world. Freemen should never regulate their conduct by the suggestions or dicta of others, for when they do so, they are no longer free. No man ought to obey any contract, written or implied, except he himself has given his personal and formal adherence thereto, when in a state of mental maturity and unrestrained liberty. It is only slaves that are born into contracts, signed and sealed by their progenitors. The freeman is born free, lives free, and dies free. He is, even though living in an artificial civilization, above all laws, all constitutions, all theories of right and wrong. He supports and defends them, of course, as long as they suit his own end, but if they don't, then he annihilates them by the easiest and most direct method. There is no obligation upon any man to passive obedience when his life, his liberty, and his property are threatened by footpad, assassin, or statesman. One of Columbus's lieutenants in the West Indies captured a Carib chief by means of a subtle stratagem. The chief was invited to a feast, and when there, persuaded with honeyed words to don, on horseback, a set of brightly polished steel manacles, it being cunningly represented to him that the irons were the regalia of sovereignty. He foolishly believed his astute flatterer, and when the chains were firmly clasped around his limbs, he was led away to die of vermin, turning a mill in a Spanish dungeon. What those glittering manacles were to the Indian chieftain, constitutions, laws, moral codes, and Hebrew-dominated civilizations are to the nations of the earth. Indeed, under the name of progress and social evolution, mankind has been lured into fetid dungeons where it labors unceasingly and for naught in darkness, despair, and shame. Like that Spanish lieutenant, the masters of the earth first flatter their dupes in order to more easily enchain them. Who talks nowadays of the sovereign people without a laugh of derision? And yet it was once thought to be a term full of significance. Their sovereignty is now acknowledged sham, and their freedom a dream. The sovereign people be damned. It is clear, therefore, that the man or nation that would retain liberty or be really safe must accept no formula as final, must trust in nothing written or unwritten, living or dead, must believe neither in special Jehovahs nor weeping saviors, neither in raging devils nor in devilish philosophies, neither in ghosts nor in idols nor in laws nor in woman nor in man. O threats of hell and hopes of paradise, one thing at least is certain, this life flies. One thing is certain, and all the rest is lies. The flower that once has bloomed forever dies. 5. He who saith unto himself, I must believe, I must not question, is not a man, but a mere pusillanimous mental gelding. He who believes because it has been handed down is a menial in his heart, and he who believes because it has been written is a fool in his folly. Sagacious spirits doubt all things and hold fast only to that which is demonstrably true. The rules of life are not to be found in Korans, Bibles, Decalogues, and constitutions, but rather the rules of decadence and death. The law of laws is not written in Hebrew consonants or upon tables of brass and stone, but in every man's own heart. He who obeys any standard of right and wrong, but the one set up by his own conscience, betrays himself into the hands of his enemies, who are ever laying in wait to bind him to their millstones. And generally a man's most dangerous enemies are his neighbors. Masterful men laugh with contempt at spiritual thunders and have no occasion to dread the decisions of any human tribunal. They are above and beyond all that. Laws and regulations are only for conquered vassals. The free man does not require them. He may manufacture and post up Decalogue regulations to bind and control dependents with, but he does not himself bow down before those inventions of his own hands, except as a lure. Statute books and golden rules were made to fetter slaves and fools. Very useful are they for controlling the herds of sentenced convicts who fill the factories and cultivate the fields. All moral principles, therefore, are the servitors, not the masters of the strong. Power made moral codes, and power abrogates them. A man is under no obligation to obey anything or anybody. It is only serving men that must obey, because they are caitiffs by birth, breeding, and condition. Morals are only required in an immoral community. That is to say, a community held in a state of conquest. Fear God, bridle the spirit, and obey the law is advice most excellent, as from a philosopher to a yokel. But when directed in all earnestness at a man of inherent might, he smiles to himself in silent scorn. Full well he knows that in actual life the path to victory and renown does not lie through Gethsemanes, but over fallen enemies, the ruins of rival combines. Through Alcidamas, meekness of spirit is regarded by him as a convenient superstition. Very useful for regulating the lives of his servants, his women, and his children, but otherwise inoperative. I rest my hopes on nothing, proclaimed Goethe, and masterful minds in all ages have never done otherwise. This unspoken thought gives to all truly great men their manifest superiority over the brainless, vociferating herd. The common people have always had to be befooled with some written or wooden or golden idol, some constitution, declaration, or gospel. Consequently, the majority of them have ever been mental thralls, living and dying in an atmosphere of strong illusion. They are befooled and hypnotized even to this hour, and a large proportion of them must remain so until time is no more. Indeed, the masses of mankind are but the sediment from which all the more valuable elements have been long ago distilled. They are totally incapable of real freedom. And if it was granted to them, they would straightway vote themselves a master or a thousand masters within 24 hours. Mastership is right. Mastership is natural. Mastership is eternal. But only for those who cannot overthrow it and trample it beneath their hoofs. It is not a fact that in actual life, the ballot box votes of 10 million subjective personalities are as thistle down to the balance when weighed against the far-seeing thought and material prowess of, say, 10 strong silent men. 6. It is notorious, universally so, that the blackest falsehoods are ever decked out in the most brilliant and gorgeous regalia. Clearly, therefore, it is the brave man's duty to regard all sacred things, all legal things, all constitutional things, all holy things, with more than usual suspicion. I deny and I affirm is the countersign of material freedom. I believe and I obey is the shibboleth of serfage. Belief is a flunky, a feminine. Doubt is a creator, a master. He who denies fundamentals is in triple armor clad. Indeed, he is invulnerable. On the other hand, it has been said that every belief, every philosophy, has some truth in it. But so we might add, has every insanity. Strong men are not deterred from pursuing their aim by anything. They go straight to the goal, and that goal is beauty, wealth, and material power. The mission of power is to control and exploit the powerless, for to be powerless is to be criminal. The world would indeed be a house of horrors if all men were good and all women padlocked. As far as human searchlights have yet penetrated into the darkness that enshrouds the origin of nations, we see the subduers and the subdued, the plebeians and the patricians, the chiefs who governed and the vassals who obeyed. And there is nothing in the most modern social developments or these deedless days to warrant any belief that this ancient natural division of human animals into castes of superiors and inferiors, sovereigns and serfs, can ever be dispensed with. The slave owner's whip cracked from the beginning, and it will crack till the day of doom. In every kingdom, republic, and empire on earth, we have, in one disguise or another, the master and the slave, the ruler and the ruled. In the course of centuries, names alone have changed. Essentials have remained the same. Forms of royalty may alter, but kings can never die. There was mastership at the beginning, and there will be mastership to the end. We build, but as our fathers built. Change is not progress, nor numbers advance. Everyone who would be free must show his power. Everyone who would be free must show his power. Unalterable remains the basis of all earthly greatness. He who exalteth himself shall be exalted, and he who humbleth himself shall be righteously trodden beneath the hoofs of the herd. The humble are only fit for dogs as meat. Bravery includes every virtue, humility every crime. He who is afraid to risk his life must never be permitted to win anything. Human rights and wrongs are not determined by justice, but by might. Disguise it as you may, the naked sword is still kingmaker and kingbreaker as of yore. All other theories are lies and lures. Therefore, if you would conquer wealth and honor, power and fame, you must be practical, grim, cool, and merciless. You must ride to success, by preference, over the necks of your foemen. Their defeat is your strength. Their downfall is your uplifting. Only the powerful can be free, and power is non-moral. Life is real. Life is earnest, and neither heaven nor hell its final goal. And love and joy and birth and death and fate and strife shall be forever. This earth is a vast whirl of warring atoms, a veritable revolving cockpit. Each molecule, each animal fights for its life. You must fight for yours or surrender. Look well to it, therefore, that your beaks and spurs, your fangs and claws are as sharp as steel and as effective as science can make them. Though the survival of the strongest is the logic of events, yet personal cowardice is the great vice of our demoralized age. Cowardice is corroding the brain and blood of our race, but men have learnt to disguise this terrible infirmity. Behind the canting whine of humanity and goodness, words flow instead of blood, and terrible insults are exchanged instead of terrible blows. How rich this degenerate world is in small, petty-souled, good-for-nothings, who are forever excusing their infantile ineptitude behind some plausible phrase, some conventional make-believe. Courage, I say, courage, not goodness, is the great desideratum. Courage that requires neither tin horns, nor calcium lights, nor brass bands, nor shouting multitudes to call it into effective action, but courage that goes its way alone, as undauntedly as when it marches to victory or death amid the menacing stride of armed and bannered legions. Courage that delights in danger. Courage that knows not despair. Courage that proudly, defiantly smiles on death. Courage that regards with equal loathing the multitude's mad howls of hate, its stupid hee-haws, and its stridulating, tremendous applause. Courage that asks no quarter, even with the knife at its throat. Courage that is stiff-necked, unyielding, sullen, pitiless. Courage that never falters, never retreats. Courage that looks down with supreme disdain upon all slave regulations, upon all rights and wrongs, upon all good and evil. Courage that has made up its mind to conquer or perish. That is the kind of courage this world lacks. That is the kind of courage that aids by active cooperation the survival of the fittest, the survival of the best. That is the kind of courage that has never turned a master's mill. That is the kind of courage that never will turn it. That is the kind of courage that will die rather than turn it. When Zvitdag came to the enclosure, the gate of the burg was shut, for it was customary to ask leave to come in and see or take part in the war games. Zvitdag did not take that trouble, but broke open the gate and rode into the yard. Queen Yssa said, "This man will be welcome here."
Chapter 2, Iconoclastic. As far as sociology is concerned, we must either abandon our reason or abandon Christ. He is preeminently the prophet of unreason, the preacher of rabble-rabies. All that is enervating and destructive of manhood he glorifies. All that is self-reliant and heroic he denounces. Lazarus, the filthy and diseased vagrant, is his hero of heroes. And Dives, the sane, energetic citizen, is his awful example of baseness and criminality. He praises the humble and he curses the proud. He blesses the failures and damns the successful. All that is noble he perverts. All that is atrocious he upholds. He inverts all the natural instincts of mankind and urges us to live artificial lives. He commands the demonetization of virtues that aggrandize a people and advises his admirers to submit in quietness to every insult, contumely, indignity, to be slaves de facto. Indeed, there is scarce one thought in the whole of his dicta that is practically true. O Christ, thou artful fiend, thou great subverter, what an amazing Iblis glamour thou hast cast over the world. Thou mean, insignificant-minded Jew. Why is it that our modern philosophers are so mortally afraid to boldly challenge the inspired utopianism of this poor self-deluded Galilean mountaineer, this preacher of all eunuch virtues, of self-abasement, of passive suffering? The sickly humanitarian ethics so eloquently raised forth by Jesus Christ and his superstitious successors in ancient Judea and throughout the moribund Roman Empire, are generally accepted in Anglo-Saxondom as the very elixir of immortal wisdom. The purest, wisest, grandest, most incontrovertible of all divine revelations or occult thaumaturgies. And yet, when closely examined, they are found to be neither divine, occult, reasonable, nor even honest, but composed almost exclusively of the stuff that nightmares are made of, together with a strong dash of oriental legerdemain. Through 1,000 different channels, current politico-economic belief is dominated by the base communistic Kabbalah of the man of many sorrows. Yet as a practical theorem, it is hardly ever critically examined. Why is it that the suggested social solutions promulgated by Jesus, Peter, Paul, James, and other Asiatic cataleptics are accepted so meekly by us upon trust? If these men were anything, they were crude socialist performers with misshapen souls, preachers of a new heaven and a new earth. That is to say, demagogues. Politicians of the slums, and out of the slums, nothing that is noble can ever be born. As agitators, Jesus and his modern continuators shall be exclusively considered in these pages. However, it must be distinctly understood that the spiritual and temporal in all cosmogonies are so intricately interwoven that it is almost impossible to completely divorce them. Like the Siamese twins, gods and governments are inextricably bound together, so much so indeed that if you kill one, the other cannot live. Hence the open or secret alliance that has always existed between the politician and the priest. Whatever their primitive purity or impurity, all operative creedal philosophies are essentially civil and military codes, police regulations. Religion is a power, a political engine, and if there was no God, I would have to invent one, said the great Napoleon. In letter and in spirit, Christianity is above all things a political theory and a theory that often takes the form of raging hysterics. Religions are the matrix in which public institutions are generally molded. This has ever been well understood by the dominant leaders of mankind, from Numa to Brigham Young, from Solon to Loyola, from Constantine to the lowest Levite hireling, who gets paid in dimes and cents for his unctuous mock dithyrambs. 2. All ye are brethren. Are all men really brethren? Negro and Indian, black fellow, Kalmuck and Cooley, the well-born and the base-bred, beer-soaked loafer and hero-hearted patriot, belted chieftain and ignoble mechanic slave, pot of iron and pot of clay. What proof is there that the brotherhood of man hypothesis is in accordance with nature? On what trustworthy biologic, historic, or other evidence does it rest? If it is natural, then rivalry, competition, and strife are unnatural. And it is proposed to prove in this book that strife, competition, rivalry, and the wholesale destruction of feeble types of men is not only natural, but highly necessary. Has brotherhood ever been tried upon earth? Where, when, and with what final result? Is not self-assertion nobler, grander, and more truly heroic than self-denial? Is not self-abasement but another term for voluntary vassalage, voluntary burden-bearing? Christ might well and truthfully have said unto his followers, "Come unto me, all ye that are weary and heavy laden, and I will bind ye in unbreakable bonds and load you down like an ass between two burdens." The poor and ignorant were his first followers, the vagrants, the disinherited, shiftless classes. And to this very day, the poorer and more ignorant men and women are, the more eager are they to follow his religious ideals or the political millennialisms that are distilled out of his delusions. If we only lived as Christ lived, what a beautiful world this would be, saith all thoughtless ones. If we lived as Christ lived, there would be none of us left to live. He begat no children. He labored not for his bread. He possessed neither house nor home. He merely taught. Consequently, he must have existed on charity or in stolen bread. If we all lived like Christ, would there have been anyone left to labor, to be begged from, to be stolen from? If we all lived like Christ, is thus a self-evident absurdity. No wonder that it is recorded, not many wise after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God chose the foolish things of the world, and God chose the weak things of the world, and the things that are despised. Nothing else would have anything to do with him. Christ was indeed the prophet of the credulous rabble during 3 years of active agitation, and it abandoned him in his hour of need. What always happens under similar circumstances. For the rabble is ever cowardly, ungenerous, suspicious, unfathomably base. It has never yet had a leader of commanding ability, either in peace or in war, that it did not ultimately desert or betray, i.e., if he did not take the precaution to make himself its master. After permitting Christ to be butchered, the mob thereupon set him up as their divinity and erected altars to his renown. Slaves, women, madmen, lepers, Magdalenes were the earliest Christians. And to this hour, women, children, slaves, and lunatics are the raw material of the Christian church. Primitive Christianity cunningly appealed to the imagination of a world of superstitious slaves, eager for some mode of escape that meant not the giving and receiving of battle strokes. It organized them for the overthrow of heroic principles and substituted for a genuine nobility based on battle selection, a crafty theocracy founded upon priestcraft, hellcraft, almsgiving, politicalisms, and all that is impure and subterranean. It is a doctrine at once disgraceful in its antecedents, its teachers, and in itself. Truly has it been called the fatal dower of Constantine, for it has suffocated, or is suffocating, the seeds of heroism. Both ancient and modern Christianism and all that has its roots therein is the negation of everything grand, noble, generous, heroic, and the glorification of everything feeble, atrocious, dishonorable, dastardly. The cross is now and ever has been an escutcheon of shame. It represents a gallows and a Semite slave swinging thereon. For 2,000 years, it has absolutely overturned human reason, overthrown common sense, infected the world with madness, submissiveness, degeneracy. Truly, there is a way which seemeth right unto a people, but the ends thereof are the ways of death. sound the loud timbrel, o'er lands and o'er waves. The Israelite triumphs, the nations are raised. 3. Is the golden rule a rational rule? Is it not rather a menial rule, a coward rule, a best policy rule? Why is it right for one man to do unto others as he would have others do to him, and what is right? If others are unable to injure him or do good to him, why should he consider them at all? Why should he take any more notice of them than of so many worms? If they are endeavoring to injure him and able to do it, why should he refrain from returning the compliment? Should he not combat them? Does that not give them carte blanche to injure and destroy him? May it not be doing good to others to war against them, to annihilate them? May it not also be good for them to war against others? Again, what is good? Is it reasonable to ask praying animals to do unto others as they would do, be done by them? If they acted accordingly, would they, could they survive? If some only accepted the golden rule as their guiding moral maxim, would they not become a prey to those who refused to abide thereby? Upon what reasonable and abiding sanction does this rule rest? Has it ever been in actual operation among men? Can it ever be successfully practiced on earth or anywhere else? Did Jesus Christ practice it himself upon all occasions? Did his apostles, his sons of thunder, practice it? Did Peter the boaster do so when he denied him for fear of arrest at the campfire? Did Judas the financier when he sold him for net cash? Also, how many of his modern lip servants actually practice it in their daily business intercourse with each other? How many? These questions require no formal answering. They answer themselves in the asking. And here it must be remembered that the best test of a witness is cross-examination. Do unto others as you would have others do to you. No base of precept ever fell from the lips of a feeble Jew. It is from alleged moralisms of this sort and fabulous principles that our mob orators, our communards, revivalists, anarchists, Red Republicans, Democrats, and other mob worshippers in general derive the infernal inspiration that they are perpetually hissing forth. Even the subversive pyrotechnic watchwords of the Mephisto Millennium are to be found in the Holy Gospels. Is it not written, "And God sendeth angels to destroy the people"? Behold, these men are the angels that he sends, politicians and reformers. 4. Love one another, you say, is the supreme law. But what power made it so? Upon what rational authority does the gospel of love rest? Is it even possible to practice? And what would result from its universal application to active affairs? Why should I not hate mine enemies and hunt them down like the wild beast that they are? Again, I ask, why? If I love them, does that not place me at their mercy? Is it natural for enemies to do good unto each other, and what is good? Can the torn and bloody victim love the blood-splashed jaws that rend it limb from limb? Are we not all predatory animals by instinct? If humans ceased wholly from preying upon each other, could they continue to exist? Love your enemies and do good to them that hate you and despitefully use you is the despicable philosophy of the spaniel that rolls upon its back when kicked. Obey it, O reader, and you and all your posterity to the 10th generation shall be irretrievably and literally damned. They shall be hewers of wood and carriers of water, degenerates, Gibeonites. But hate your enemies with a whole heart, and if a man smite you on one cheek, smash him down, smite him hip and thigh, for self-preservation is the highest law. He who turns the other cheek is a cowardly dog, a Christian dog. Give blow for blow, scorn for scorn, doom for doom, with compound interest liberally added thereunto, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, eye fourfold, a hundredfold. Make yourself a terror to your adversary, and when he goeth his way, he will possess much additional wisdom to ruminate over. Thus shall you make yourself respected in all the walks of life, and your spirit, Your immortal spirit shall live not in intangible paradise, but in the brains and thews of your aggressive and unconquerable sons. After all, the true proof of manhood is a splendid progeny, and it is a scientific axiom that the timid animal transmits timidity to its descendants. If men lived like brothers and had no powerful enemies to contend with and surpass, they would rapidly lose all their best qualities, like certain oceanic birds that lose the use of their wings because they do not have to fly from pursuing beasts of prey. If all men had treated each other with brotherly love since the beginning, what would have been the result now? If there had been no wars, no rivalry, no competition, no kingship, no slavery, no survival of the toughest, no racial extermination, truly what a festering hell fenced in this old globe would be. 5. Reverend Ferdinand M. Sprague of Chicago, who may be taken as a common specimen of the priest politician, in a little pamphlet lately published entitled The Laws of Social Evolution, writes thus: "The sheet anchor of socialism, according to its ablest exponents, is the Holy Christian religion. Its motto, founded on the precept, love thy neighbor as thyself, is each for all and all for each. Its working principle for the present is altruism. Nearly all the canonized fathers of the early Roman propaganda, most of whom, by the way, were slaves, freedmen, or eunuchs, advocated similar ideals. Even now, the anointed and sanctified head of the Catholic Church resurrects the same hoary old utopianism in a Jesuitic encyclical addressed to his flock. How suggestive of being shorn and skinned is that word, flock? Again, the Epistle of James, who is known to have been Christ's full brother, killed by a special policeman's club in a street riot, has been reprinted and widely circulated by socialists in order to sow and broadcast their illogical theories of a universal brotherhood founded upon enforced labor, regimentation of the herd, and majority votes. Many modern cities are also infested with plausible epileptoid priestlings of unreason, like Dr. McGlynn, Professor Bemis, Hugh Price Hughes, W.T. Stead, Myron Reed, and Professor Heron of California. All these men are unrivaled masters in the art of persuasive declamation. They accept the New Testament as their textbook and preach therefrom to morbid multitudes the atrocious and shallow gospel of equal rights, equal liberty, equal brotherhood, as the veritable omnific word, the newly discovered emancipating protocol of the crucified yet almighty Don Quixote, the savior god of Asia Minor, who was born in a cattle shed and died on a gallows." 6. A god begging his bread from door to door. A god without...
Well, there you go, boys and girls. That's it. That's the bottom line. And when you're watching that silly inauguration tomorrow, just remember what you've heard today. Yeah. And don't laugh too hard. And I will be back tomorrow on Freya's Day, Ladies' Day in the bunker, and we'll pick up where we left off. So remember that. Yous all equal, man. I's all equal, man.
Northern in the state, 75, with a nervous fading beauty sitting by his side, and a pistol that he used to pave the way down the long black stretches of a dark highway. Rape all his future with a pound of lead, and he robbed him every store and left the clerk dead. That kid should have put the money in the sack, but he didn't, and now there ain't no turning back. He's just a rider, he's just a James. Guess that he can go far, it's a household name. There ain't nobody that a man can trust, and all his head we is no phobia. There ain't nobody that a man can trust, and all his They pulled out and started naming Matt Wilmer's line. The East Road with the lights off, for the red blind. Rick Hilton motor at the county line. Jersey's Tennessee plays to a lost tag sound. The season never passed what the boy had done. She should be as hostage as we need a fire. Her mom read to say, Lord, through. Thank you.